This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Halo, Legacy of Onyx by Matt Forbeck. Read by Scott Brick.
Historian's Note. While this novel begins in 2549, a few years before the end of the Covenant War, the bulk of Halo Legacy of Onyx takes place in 2558 and steps into the average lives of those who were trying to normalize and rebuild. Its tale comes to full stride alongside the Halo Fractures short story Lesson Learned, which follows a pair of Spartan Threes who were suddenly requisitioned for a highly classified assignment in the most mysterious location in the galaxy. Chapter 1. Memory fades, especially memories from childhood. The older one gets, the further they recede, until it almost seems as if there were no childhood at all. Molly Patel was not that old, and she could barely remember anything from before she was 7. She could, however, remember some things that happened when she was 7. There was one thing in particular she would never forget. 9 years ago, back in 2549, the day her homeworld, Paris 4, died. She remembered the sky burning. Monstrous alien starships scudded through the blazing clouds, glowing with unearthly power. Gargantuan machines hung in the sky, spitting out smaller craft that swarmed among them like angry hornets, hurling down destruction on everything below. Wave after wave of those vessels brought hell to the surface of her planet. The invaders spilled out the sides of their transports, violent energy blasting from their weapons as they cursed her people in strange alien tongues. Their sole purpose was to attack the humans on Paris 4, to destroy their homes, to kill every single one of them. The only thing that kept Molly and her family alive during the global assault was simply that the invaders hadn't yet caught up with them on their terrified attempt to escape. "We're not going to make it," her mother Bridget mouthed as their vehicle raced down an empty road that wound out of their neighborhood, tracing the shoreline and leading toward the nearest evacuation point. In a moment of panic, Molly's mother had slipped into unveiled honesty. Had she given it thought, she would probably have said something different, at least for Molly's sake. Before Molly's family had left their house, her mother had frantically strapped her into the seat as if Molly was an orbital drop shock trooper, one of the legendary hell jumpers who would launch down from a perfectly good UNSC ship into the heart of war. Those were the good guys, the ones who were battling in the streets to save Molly's homeworld, and failing miserably. Molly remembered the lines of worry on her mother's face as she peered back from the front passenger seat. That expression had been deepening for hours, ever since the first signs of the invasion, and now those lines looked as if they might actually crack, causing her to crumble with them. Molly wanted to say something to her mother to make her feel better, but she was 7. She didn't have the words. If she was being honest, she maybe still didn't. Somehow, her mother stayed strong. "We would have been killed going the other way for sure," Molly's father Gautam had said with a slight quiver in his voice. "You saw what they did to the highway back there." The family was heading for the spaceport, just as the emergency broadcasts had insisted, but they had gotten a late start. Molly's parents had been trying to contact her older sister Grace, who had spent the night at a friend's house. When they tried to call, they found that the comm lines had all been completely overloaded with traffic. They couldn't get through to her, no matter how hard they tried. Eventually, her parents had given up and driven as quickly as they could to the house where Grace had been. When her mother dashed through the open front door, though, no one was inside. The family Grace was staying with had already abandoned the place. They'd taken Molly's sister with them. Or so Molly had hoped. That was when things started to come unglued for Molly. She started to cry, just a little, as softly as she could. She was missing Grace already. The horror of losing track of her sister at such a crucial moment had marred her mom's face when she returned to the car. Another thing that Molly still remembered, and quite clearly, that look. Her dad had assured both of them that Grace would be fine, that she had probably left in the first wave of evacuations. They just needed to get off the planet themselves now, he told them. Eventually they'd find her. Of course, they never did. By the time they got close to the highway that led to the spaceport, even Molly could see they would never be able to even reach that road. Vehicles just sat there, stacked in either direction as far as the eye could see. They moved, but in almost imperceptible increments. Molly's dad stopped the car and got out, scanning the road every which way to see what their options might be. That's when things really fell apart. The aliens, who had been a remote threat entirely out of sight, suddenly became very real. A gigantic, unnervingly strange ship, larger than any building Molly had ever seen, descended from a dark cloud and came thundering in over the highway. It loomed there ominously for a long moment, casting its vast shadow over the thousands of vehicles clogging the road for kilometers ahead, as if it were waiting for something. Orders? A word from their alien gods? Then the ship fired a massive beam of energy from its belly. It lanced straight down to the ground, several thousand meters in front of where the family's vehicle had stopped. Molly's mom shouted at her to shield her eyes, but the pull of her own curiosity was stronger than her mother's voice. She stared at the staggering destruction stretching before her for as long as she could. She was simply too stunned to blink, much less turn away. It was unlike anything Molly had ever seen in her life, or had seen since. The beam was so bright it physically hurt her eyes, but she couldn't tear her gaze from it. Although it struck the road more than a kilometer away, she could still feel its scorching heat on her face. As vehicles exploded, and the earth below the beam completely gave way. Even through the 100-meter waves of dust and debris the ship's weapon kicked up, Molly could see what the aliens were doing to the surface of her planet, the place she had called home. The beam melted everything it touched into a bright, glowing slag that flowed like torrents of lava, churning out and away from the beam's impact, before it shifted from white to red to black as it cooled. Molly's dad wasted no more time. He leaped back behind the wheel and spun the vehicle around, taking off in a new, desperate direction as he hunted for another route to the spaceport. He didn't have a plan, and he had no time to come up with one. This gut reaction was the best he could muster. But so far, that hadn't done Molly's family much good. "We're still 10 kilometers from the evacuation site," her mom said. "We should have left sooner, Gautam. We shouldn't have let Grace..." Bridget stopped herself. "I wish we lived closer." "Stop. How could we have anticipated this?" Molly's dad said, as they darted past an abandoned car on the side of the road. "And Grace will be fine, Bridget. She has to be." Molly craned her neck as they bolted down the highway. She was trying to watch a cluster of people who had gotten out of their vehicle. They were on their knees, praying. Some part of Molly, even at the age of 7, had wondered if those people had the right idea. She had seen the ship. She had seen what the aliens were capable of. Who can escape that? And if we can't get away, what is the point in running now? Maybe it would have been better to pull off to the side of the road as well, and make their peace while they waited for the end to come. In the end, Molly was glad it wasn't her decision to make. She was just a kid back then. But even when she recalled this moment years later, she wasn't sure she would have kept on going. Another vehicle suddenly hurtled past them, headed in the other direction. On this road, they hadn't seen anyone going away from the evacuation point all morning. That car was headed toward the destruction. Why? "Not a good sign," her mother remarked. That's insane, Gautam replied, shaking his head. They go back that way, they're going to run straight into the Covenant. What could be so much worse in this direction? At this point, nothing. Without thinking, Molly instinctively reached over to the empty seat next to her, the one where Grace should have been. She'd done it hundreds of times before. It was like second nature. But this time Grace wasn't there to comfort her. Molly's heart sank, and she bit her lip. In the far distance, the city of Mimir suddenly came into view, its towers defiantly spearing up into the sky. Molly's family had chosen to live on the outskirts, farther from the spaceport. She'd often wondered if that decision had cost them precious time. Without warning, another huge Covenant ship descended from the clouds and ignited its own ground-melting weapon, ripping into Mimir's skyscrapers as if they were paper. It was humbling to see such majestic human structures tumble to the ground in seconds. For a long moment, the car was filled only with silence. Nothing could have prepared them for what this day had brought. It was too awful for the imagination. Then the silence was jarringly broken, drawing Molly's attention back to the road ahead. "There's another one," Molly's mom said, as a second car passed theirs going the opposite direction. Her dad cursed. "And there's more up ahead of us. What's going on?" From the back seat, Molly peered between them, trying to figure out what the other drivers were doing if the evacuation site was their only chance for survival. Stumped, she looked past them and toward the spaceport as it came into view. It still seemed so far away, like a cluster of tall buildings emerging from the sea. One after another, ships, human ships, rose stridently up into the sky on tails of fire and smoke. They weren't alone, though. Smaller Covenant craft suddenly burst from within the clouds and chased the escaping ships as they fled. Some of the refugee shuttles managed to soar straight past the aliens, whisking their passengers from the grim fate of Paris IV to the safety of invisible stars. Other ships weren't so fortunate. The swarm of Covenant fighters caught them, unleashing a barrage of white-hot energy at their hulls, transfixing each for a moment like a moth in a flashlight's beam, until it exploded in a flash. Like thunder that came after lightning, the noise of their destruction didn't reach Molly's ears until seconds later. A series of low thuds punching through the air, synced with the precise order of destruction. The impulse to weep over those who had died followed almost immediately, even though Molly had likely known none of them. But they were humans, fellow citizens of Paris IV. For a brief moment, Molly wondered if Grace was on one of those ships. For a 7-year-old who loved her older sister, there wasn't much that could be more painful than that. The vision of the falling debris still choked Molly up when her mind went back to that day. At the time, she didn't think she was making that much of a commotion in the back seat. But her mother noticed soon enough. She reached back and held Molly's hand to comfort her. But her father didn't respond at all. He was too focused on something up ahead. Molly wiped the heavy tears that had welled up in her eyes and tried to see what her father was fixated on. The road rising before them led toward a bridge that extended over a river flowing into the nearby ocean, the location of the spaceport. Molly followed the structure of the bridge with her eyes and spotted a tremendous gap in its center. It had been severed completely in half. Long, twisted bits of rebar stuck out of the ends of the shattered concrete, like broken fingers reaching for the other side. "Well, that explains why everyone was turning around," her dad said. His voice sounded distant, unreal, as if in complete disbelief. "Damn it. The nav system should have reported that." Her mom grimaced. "If the Covenant hadn't taken down all the comm networks, it would have." Her dad punched the dashboard with his fist and cursed again. He looked down at the readouts for what seemed like a long time, and then, without warning, stomped on the accelerator. The engine growled like a starving beast, and the vehicle suddenly launched forward. Molly's mother somehow held back her surprise and managed to gently put her other hand on his arm. clearly straining to be as calm as possible. "The bridge is gone, Gautam. We can't make it across. Do we have any choice?" Molly's dad glared down the road ahead as the vehicle rocketed onto the actual bridge. He showed no sign of stopping. "Isn't it better to die trying?" As the car veered around a handful of abandoned vehicles and shot toward that horrifying gap, the weight of what her father said hit Molly, and she screamed in terror. She couldn't help it any longer. Her mind started imagining the feeling of falling. They were only seconds from tumbling headlong into the open sky past the bridge's shattered edge, and from there straight down into the water below. Maybe that would have been better than being melted to death. But by how much? "Hun, we can't make that jump." Brigid's grip on Gautam's arm tightened, but her voice remained steady and even as she refused to look ahead. Molly couldn't keep her eyes off the road. As the vehicle rushed even closer toward the edge of the bridge, her dad suddenly blinked as though he had finally snapped out of a trance. He switched feet and stomped down on the brake pedal instead. The sudden change in momentum thrust Molly forward against her seat restraints until they bit into her shoulders, and the car swerved back and forth, struggling desperately to come to a stop. She could smell the stench of burning rubber, and she wondered if maybe he'd changed his mind a little too late. The car violently came to a rest, though, just shy of the last possible moment. The horrible fall Molly had expected never came. The empty space beyond the broken steel and concrete stretched before them. They sat only meters from the edge.
"Okay. Okay.
You're right," Gautam said, his voice shaking. Molly had never heard him like this. Beads of sweat rolled down the side of his face as his hands gripped the wheel. He took a deep breath, trying to steady himself.
"We have to go back."
"And then what?" her mom asked.
"I really don't know."
He swallowed hard, then put the car in reverse, hit the gas, and wrenched the wheel around, spinning in the opposite direction.
"Maybe we can make it to the tunnel at Cochineal Pass," he said. "You think that's going to save us?"
Brigid asked in disbelief. The car lurched forward again as Gautam leaned on the accelerator and wrestled it back into the middle of the road.
"Has to be better than standing underneath one of those ships with nothing between you but empty sky."
Like the cars they'd seen before going in the opposite direction, the family now raced back as fast as they'd come. Soon they passed once again the same people praying on the side of the road. More of them stood gathered there now. A few new carloads had joined, probably seeking solace in one another's company for what they knew would be their final moments. Molly caught a flash of them that she never forgot, an image imprinted in her mind. They were standing there, clutching one another's hands. Even years later, she could still make out their faces. Some of them hugged their loved ones tight. Most wept. Once their car zipped past the roadside supplicants, Molly turned forward again and peered through the windshield. One of the Covenant ships a dozen or so kilometers away, probably the same one from before, was slowly canting toward their car. Its unrelenting beam continued destroying everything in its path, like a tornado of light. For a second, Molly wondered what had happened to the traffic they'd seen ahead. Before she could give it much thought, it quickly grew warmer in their car. Her skin went moist with sweat. The ship was still far from them, but its blindingly white beam was slowly drawing closer, causing a swift descent of the temperature, like that of a heating oven. Molly's mom reached back and held her hand. "It's going to be all right, Molly." Even then, she could tell how much of a lie that was, that her mother was saying it simply to help her feel better. Still, Molly couldn't blame her.
"I know, Mommy."
Molly could lie, too. As her dad squeezed every bit of speed he could muster out of the car, the enormous ship edged toward the vehicle from the right, and the vicious sound of its weapon grew impossibly loud. Just over the guardrail, stretched out below, Molly could see the valley where the beam had launched its approach. It bore a long, jagged trench of scorched earth.
"Hang on," "We're going to make it. I promise you that," her father said through gritted teeth, as he slung the car around a corner toward the mountain pass. The mouth of the tunnel suddenly appeared up ahead, and the road snaked into it. Even as it grew closer, it still felt so far away. At the same time, the dark purple starship loomed toward their car, drawing nearer by the second. The nose of the vessel disappeared over the roof of the car. All Molly could see now was white light from its destructive beam, plunging out of its gut toward the earth below and blotting out most of the sky. Molly finally had to turn away. It was too close to bear.
"Gautam, are you sure?"
Her mother gave voice to the doubts that had been growing in Molly's own mind. She wanted to believe her father's words, but an unshakable fear had already gripped her heart.
"Giving it everything we got," he replied, struggling to keep his voice composed.
There was no traffic. The road was vacant. To Molly it felt as if they were the only ones left on Paris 4, the only ones still trying to survive. All the others, it seemed, had either made peace with their impending doom, or had already met it. But for some reason, her family had held out hope. The car roared on, and Molly kept her eyes fixed ahead. The bright, lethal light now blanketed everything on the right, crushing all of the shadows in the car and filling it with a searing heat. In front, the dark, safe tunnel rushed toward the vehicle. Molly's fingers dug deeper into her seat's armrests as waves of grit and debris from the beam's impact on the valley below pummeled the side of the car. The Covenant ship was right on top of them. At any second, the blaze would consume them. Her family's desperate quest to reach the mouth of the tunnel felt so achingly slow, as though time had nearly stopped. Molly would later remember vividly how the vehicle hurtled toward the gaping maw, a dark and chilly refuge that promised to swallow them, to protect them from the fatal touch of the Covenant's scorching light. Molly began to bounce up and down in her seat, screaming as the overwhelming light forced her to close her eyes. She felt so full of unbridled terror that her 7-year-old self was trying to will the car to go faster by shaking the seat with all of her might.
"Go, Daddy," she shouted. "Go, go, 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 go."
Her mom squeezed her hand so tight it hurt. But Molly didn't complain. The pain meant she was still alive.
"Hold on," her dad shouted. "Almost there."
"Don't stop, Gautam," said Bridget.
Even with her eyes shut tight, Molly could see the melting beam's wall of light through her eyelids as it flooded into the car. It felt as if a tsunami of blinding heat were reaching out to devour them. As they drew close to the tunnel, their back now to the ship, Molly risked opening her eyes. She could see trees and large boulders from the surrounding area being swept across the road directly in front of them, as though they were caught up in a cyclone. The vehicle was just seconds away from the tunnel when the inside of the car suddenly became superheated, forcing Molly to gasp for air. In an instant, she felt as if she had been physically placed on a sun, her skin beginning to burn, her throat and eyes immediately going dry, as if being cooked alive. She could no longer see even the blackness of the tunnel's mouth. The heat and light had blown everything out. Molly closed her eyes again, expecting the end. An instant later, they emerged from the blinding nimbus and bulleted into the tunnel, miraculously swallowed by the darkness. Her eyes had trouble adjusting at first. Slowly things came into focus, but her ears still pulsed with the beam's churning cacophony, even as it grew farther away. The rapid change in temperature was as if she'd jumped into an icy lake on the hottest summer day. As much as she welcomed it over the deadly heat, it shocked the air from her lungs. She couldn't breathe. She couldn't do anything but look into her mother's face. Molly could faintly see a small smile of relief from the front passenger seat. She also saw what lay ahead, and couldn't warn her father to slow down. She didn't have the breath or the words. All she could do was point ahead when she saw the taillights racing toward them at full speed. Her dad's eyes hadn't adjusted in time, and he spotted the problem too late. He slammed on the brakes again,
but the vehicle's momentum was simply too great. Molly didn't remember the impact, but she knew what happened. Their car rear-ended a truck at full speed, the front end of their vehicle crumpling like a paper bag. The vehicle's airbags must have instantly inflated, enveloping her in a cushioning cocoon, even as it tore her mother's grip away. The last thing she remembered was hearing her mother shout her name. Then everything went completely dark, and she didn't know anything else. Not for a while, at least. Some time later, she couldn't tell how long for sure, Molly awakened to find herself still strapped in her seat, but unable to see anything in the pitch black. For a moment, she wondered if she was dead. Maybe this is what it's like. Molly's parents weren't religious at all, and they hadn't done much to prepare her at such a young age for thoughts of the afterlife. For all she knew, a person's body just stopped working, and the person was stuck inside it, unable to do anything else ever again. But she was in too much pain for that to be the case. Molly ached from head to toe, and her mouth felt as dry as a desert. She was exhausted and in agony, but most of all, she needed water. She reached up to touch her face and had a moment of horrible panic when she realized that she couldn't feel her hands. Soon she figured out that the car had stopped and pitched forward at a sharp angle, and she was hanging from her seat's safety restraints. The harness had cut off the circulation in her arms. Her hands were still there, though, and they worked, even if they felt clumsy. She brushed her hair from her face and felt something rough crusted on her skin. Molly knew it had to be blood. Then through the darkness came an awful stench, like rot mixed with spilled fuel and vomit. She wanted to plug her nose, and for a moment she tried breathing only through her mouth. The scent was indescribably awful, but she tried to focus on other things. How long have I been out? Is the Covenant ship still blasting the ground just outside the tunnel? What happened to my parents? The cold silence from the front of the car answered the last question. Only when Molly was older would she realize that the smell had come from them. She fumbled with the catch on her seat's safety straps, but she couldn't seem to work the release. Her fingers were just too numb, and she couldn't make them function properly. She tried for as long as she could manage before giving up and letting them drop slack again. As Molly hung in the car, feeling frustrated and hopeless, memories of what had happened began to flood back. She began to cry, softly at first, then in big sobbing gulps. She was tired, but somehow she had enough energy left for tears. She pleaded with her mother and father to wake up, to be alive. All she wanted was to give up. For some length of time, Molly just hung there and let her mind be drawn into a black hole of grief. Then, without warning, the back window of the car shattered, showering her with broken glass. The sudden noise startled her to the core, and she screamed in response, thinking that the Covenant had finally found her. It wasn't enough that they had leveled her entire world. Now they had to find her here and finish her off, too. Molly bit back her cries, realizing that she should have been quieter. But it was already too late. They'd found her. She took a deep breath and cringed as she waited to die. Flashlight beams shone down into the car from behind her. She could now see that the car had tilted forward on impact. Its nose had jammed deep under the truck it had barreled into, lifting the entire back of the car off the ground. That was when she saw them. The barest glimpse of her parents, still in the front. They didn't move. They just hung against their seatbelts. Limp. Gone. "I found one," a man shouted above her. "She's alive!" A wave of relief washed over Molly. She'd been convinced that it was the Covenant who'd discovered her, thinking she'd be hauled out by a giant alien with jagged teeth. Instead, this was a human. She'd been saved. Then Molly really began to weep. not from terror, but from a chaotic mix of emotions she could barely understand. There was relief, for certain, but it was blended with the overwhelming loss of her parents, as well as what she'd later come to know as survivor's guilt. She was alive, and they were not. Her parents hadn't been alone in that. Most of Molly's homeworld hadn't made it either, including Grace, as she would only later discover. "It's all right," the man said to her. "I got you." He reached in and cut one of her car seat's shoulder straps with a large knife. Then he wrapped his free arm around her so she wouldn't fall and gently sliced through the other strap. Once she was free, he sheathed the weapon and with his strong, calloused hands, pulled her backward and up through the car's rear window, lifting her as if she were little more than a doll. Molly heard other people, shouting, tramping in her direction. But she didn't pay any attention to them. She just curled up against her savior's broad chest and cried quietly into his uniform. When she opened her eyes, she saw the name stenciled on his shirt. The image of it burned into Molly's brain. It read, "Sergeant Johnson." Chapter 2. September 2558. The sky over Aranuka was bright and blue as Molly Patel strolled home from school. In the 5 years that she had lived in the vast city platform, built above the original atoll that had long since vanished under the waves of the Pacific Ocean, Molly had come to love how new it seemed compared to anywhere else she'd ever been. It was almost as if it had been pulled fresh from a package and dropped right onto the water. It may have seemed a bit too fresh to some. It still had a new city smell, mostly because not enough people had moved back here after the war ended. But Molly knew that's what was bound to happen, after the Covenant finally found Earth and attacked the ground anchors of the planet's key space tethers in their invasion. Aranuka housed one of those spots, and the Covenant had nearly taken the tether there down. It made sense to her that people might be somewhat reluctant to shoot roots in a place that had been almost entirely removed from the map just a few years ago. The tragic part was that the Covenant hadn't been all that interested in the tether to begin with. Humanity had plenty of other ways to get into space, so a giant freight elevator wasn't that vital a target for the invaders. According to records released shortly after the attack, they had apparently thought an artifact was hidden under the platform, something of incredible value to them, left behind by an ancient race of beings known as the Forerunners, a civilization that had long since disappeared from the galaxy. They had been willing to tear the entire area to pieces to find it. Not much had been left of the original Aranuka platform after the United Nations Space Command drove the Covenant off, though the space elevator itself had survived. That was probably why the Unified Earth government had set to rebuilding the city so quickly. It was part of their global Project Rebirth, an ambitious drive to plaster over the gaping holes the alien ships had clawed out of the planet, in places such as there and New Mombasa. For the most part, it had worked. The Aranuka platform and elevator looked better than they ever had, a sparkling jewel strung on a glittering chain set in the center of the Pacific, thousands of kilometers from anywhere else. The only trouble was that not too many citizens were eager to move back in. Besides, of course, the folks Molly referred to as her new parents, the people who had adopted her after the destruction of Paris IV. Back when the Covenant invaded Earth, Molly and her new parents had been living in Wisconsin, 7 time zones to the east of Aranuka, somewhat removed from much of the battle. But for a xenolinguist, Yong Li, and an honest-to-God archaeologist, Asha Moyamba, the lure of properly exploring an archaeological dig such as the one the Covenant had started right beneath Aranuka proved far too appealing. Even though Molly had tried to deter them, no force on Earth could keep them from taking advantage of that opportunity. Despite her objections, Molly and her new parents wound up on the city platform of Aranuka, and Molly was now slated to be part of one of the first graduating classes to attend all 4 years, at Admiral Harper High School. After finishing there, Molly had only one goal. She planned to join the UNSC. This time the decision would be entirely hers, and it would most certainly be over and against Young and Asha's objections. The tables would finally turn. Young had lost a sister who'd been a tough-as-nails orbital drop shock trooper, which had been tragic for everyone who was close to her. By all accounts, though, she'd known exactly what she'd signed up for, and she would have been the first to admit it. But because of that loss, Young refused to risk losing anyone else in action. That included his adopted daughter. Regardless, after how the military had saved Molly's life back on Paris IV, she felt a deeply rooted obligation to serve in some capacity, no matter how dangerous a career it might be. Marines, such as Sergeant Johnson, were her heroes. And if she was completely honest, Molly wanted to be a hero for someone like her 7-year-old self, too. Especially now that the future of the galaxy seemed as uncertain as ever. The war might have come to a close, but rumors of chaos continued to abound. Apparently human insurgents had started to take up a lot of the slack in the Terror Department, a problem humanity had known well before the Covenant War had interrupted it. And the Covenant wasn't quite dead yet, either. Back in Wisconsin, Molly had felt fairly safe, at least until the Covenant had figured out the location of Earth. Wisconsin just felt so far away from anything that had to do with the war. Here in Aranuka, though, the ghosts of the thousands of people who had died at the Covenant's hands seemed to haunt every street corner. And in the years since, not too many of the living had showed up to crowd them out. The UEG had rebuilt Aranuka, and a number of other Earth cities hit hard by the Covenant, in an effort to help the planet heal. But this remote island paradise still stood so hollow and lifeless. Businesses and the military continued to use the tether to move freight to outer space and back, but most of that had become automated long before the Covenant showed up. Molly's history teacher said that this tiny atoll had never really held a large population to begin with. Only about 1,000 folks had lived there before its beaches had been swept under the waves. Maybe about 10 times that many had called it home a few centuries later, just before the Covenant's vicious invasion. Still, the small population wasn't all that bad for Molly. It meant that even on the salaries of a couple of academics, her family could afford a penthouse apartment in one of the nicest sections of town, with wide windows that opened onto the Pacific Ocean to the north and west. Maybe Molly didn't see anyone else in the lobby when she entered the building, and maybe the elevator didn't stop a single time on her way to the top, but the view at sunset was gorgeous. It was like something from a dream, even if a quiet and uneasy restlessness clouded most of her days. But today was different. The moment Molly walked into their apartment, she knew something was wrong. Both of her adoptive parents' briefcases sat next to each other on a bamboo bench near the door. Given the dedication they had to their respective professions, especially since moving to Aranuka, this was disturbingly odd. They shouldn't have been home this early. Despite the circumstances of their arrival in her life, Molly loved them both. She didn't have any other living relatives, or at least any willing to raise an orphan in the middle of a war. Asha and Young had been college friends of her real parents, and after she'd survived Paris IV, they'd taken her in without hesitation. Despite everything else that was going on in their lives, they'd graciously made room for Molly in their hearts, which even now gave her reason to pause and be thankful. If she hadn't been utterly traumatized by the glassing of her homeworld, everything would have been picture-perfect. Looking back at the first few years after Paris IV, Molly realized that she had been a handful for them. At the time, she'd just wanted her real parents back. It didn't matter to her how wonderful the substitutes might be. Early on, her new parents had even helped Molly look for Grace. Molly had fantasized that if her sister was somehow alive, Grace could have taken custody of her instead, Grace would have only been 12 at the time. But somehow that hadn't mattered to Molly. Grace was actual flesh and blood. Family. At least the two of them would have had each other, Molly rationalized. That would have been enough. Instead, within weeks, Molly and her new parents had learned that the escape ship Grace and her friend's family had filed onto was incinerated on the launch pad before it could take off. Molly remembered the day she found out. She even remembered exactly where she was. They had been in Wisconsin. Asha and Young had come home from work early to give her the news the moment she came home from school. They sat Molly down on the couch in the living room and broke the news to her as gently as they could. It didn't matter. It felt as if the Covenant had murdered Grace all over again. Molly cried for weeks, refusing to talk to anyone. Despite the early struggles of their new relationship with Molly, Asha and Young had never tried to take the place of Molly's parents. Not entirely. Even though they were the ones raising her, they sincerely wanted to remember their old friends just as much as she did. They kept a framed picture of Molly's parents in the living room, and often told her about the wonderful things they had all done back in college. It was vividly clear to Molly that they genuinely cared about one another. Asha and Young didn't have any children of their own, and for the most part they seemed pretty thrilled to have Molly around. But they worked long hours, something she'd come to appreciate over the past few years. After Molly would get home from school, she had complete freedom until they got back from work, and that buffer had helped her cope with a lot of the pain she'd wrestled with. Molly eventually came to prize that solitude, that freedom. It was the one time of day she didn't have to deal with peers or anyone looking over her shoulder. It was her time alone. Though she now fought it, memories of the day Asha and Young had come home early with the news of Grace began weighing down in the pit of her stomach. She wondered what other kind of information could possibly drag them both away from work. Asha greeted Molly from the couch in their living room with a wide, toothy smile. Asha had long, sleek hair, dark and shiny as her eyes, which glinted with curiosity and kindness. She liked to wear long, flowing clothes, and since the move to Aranuka, she'd adopted most of its native Polynesian styles because of how much they delighted her. Embracing this new culture was one of her newfound joys. "Hi, Molly." Molly crinkled her brow. "You're home early." "Yes, well, Young and I have something to tell you," Asha said, completely ignoring Molly's suspicions. Molly cocked her head and sauntered into the living room, which was filled with wicker furniture on a bamboo floor and slanting sunlight, also part of Asha's efforts to embrace the local culture. The hopeful look in her eyes only made Molly more nervous. Something was off. But this clearly wasn't bad news. Then Young strode into the living room from the kitchen and stood beside Asha. Young was tall and rangy, his dark hair cropped in a sharp and stylish cut. He'd recently started wearing half-moon gold-rimmed glasses, with which he could pull up data at will for his job. But he had them folded up and stuffed into his blazer's breast pocket. He clearly didn't want to be distracted. Whatever this was, he was big. Young leaned over the back of the couch, which faced toward the sea, and put a hand on Asha's shoulder, presenting Molly with a united front. When they were both standing, Young towered at least a foot over Asha, but despite their vast differences in style, height, and temperament, to Molly they always seemed like a well-matched pair. "It's huge news, sweetie," he said, wearing the same fragile smile as Asha. This sounded familiar to Molly. The two had pulled the same trick when they'd announced the family was moving to Aranuka. To Molly, it had turned out all right in the end, but at the time she'd done a great job of making them all miserable. She'd absolutely hated moving, especially being uprooted. She did not share her new parents' excitement over novelty and change. Molly dropped her chin and stared at the floor for a moment. She thought for a split second that maybe if she waited long enough, they would see how upset the whole thing had already made her and forego spilling whatever it was that would wreck her world. That didn't happen.
They were far more patient than Molly, so she eventually gave up and raised her eyes to meet theirs, forcing the words out of her mouth.
"Okay, guys. What is it?"
"We got new jobs." Asha's smile spread even wider. "Both of us, as a matter of fact." Young came around from behind the couch and sat down next to Asha. He gave her a proud, sidelong hug. Molly sighed. A stab of fear hit her insides, validating all of the dread that had built up since she'd stepped through the front door and seen their briefcases. She wanted to be happy for them, but a change of employment wasn't what this announcement was about. This was just the prologue. "Don't fret." Young held out a hand as if that would allay Molly's fears. "We're all going." That answered that question. Molly tried to put on a serious face and handle this with maturity, but everything in her fought against it. "So, that means we're moving? Again?" She sat down next to Asha. "I was just starting to like it here." Asha reached up and put a gentle hand on Molly's shoulder. "Yeah, I know it's another move. There have been a lot of them, haven't there?" Asha said, echoing Molly's concerns. "After this, though, I don't think we'll be moving again for a long time. Maybe never." Never? The thought had rarely entered Molly's mind, as she just assumed all homes were temporary. She wasn't sure how she felt about something permanent. Molly didn't have too many friends in Aranuka. There weren't all that many others her age here. At least, not yet. But she hadn't made a lot of friends back in Wisconsin, either. That was for an entirely different reason. Many of the kids there had family in the UNSC. A number of them had even lost someone they loved in a war. But none of them had survived the glassing of a planet. Except for Molly. The media had made such a big deal out of her survival that some had taken to calling her the miracle child. Molly was one of only a handful of people to have lived through the destruction of Paris 4, and the story of her unexpected rescue in the tunnel had been blasted across the news feeds. The real miracle was that anyone had been looking for survivors at all. Most of the UNSC was, by that point, pulling out of the star system, abandoning what little was left of the planet. That Molly was in a tunnel when the land around her was glassed had made a huge difference. If not for the accident that had lifted the back of her car off the ground, above the liquefied material that surged into the tunnel, she probably wouldn't have made it either. In some weird twist of fate, the glassing of Paris 4 had ultimately kept Molly alive long enough for her to be rescued. Molly had wound up in a military hospital for almost a week, and it had taken the UNSC another week to get her on a transport headed for Earth. She had only been 7 at the time, but she still remembered desperately trying to find out what might have happened to Grace the whole time she was there. No one could tell her. In the years that followed, Molly had found herself slowly becoming obsessed with news about the war, and with the UNSC in general. Part of it had stemmed from a genuine interest in humanity's survival. The Covenant threat was real and needed to be stopped. But the other part was that she desperately wanted to find and thank Sergeant Avery Johnson for hauling her out of that mess. She never got the chance to see him again. Apparently he died helping the legendary Spartan super soldier, the Master Chief, stop the Covenant once and for all. Or so the declassified version of the story went. By the time Asha and Young had brought Molly home, news of the arrival of the Miracle Child had reached their town in Wisconsin. Because of that, people treated Molly differently. She wasn't an average little girl to them, but a conversation point over dinner. Given her loss and the spectacle surrounding her survival, it took a long time for her to start feeling like a normal kid again. Therapy helped in the early years, but eventually her psychologist said she'd done all she could, and Molly would have to continue her journey on her own. So she did. Shortly after that, they'd made their way to Aranuka. Although Molly had been against it at first, coming to this isolated place had helped in ways she had not foreseen. Many of the people who lived alongside them had lost family to the Covenant just like her. Even though the war was over, some people would still be fighting the pain it had brought till the day they died. So they had that in common, at least. It may have been mostly empty, but over the years, Aranuka had slowly become home. And now that was going to end. "You're going to love it," Young said, veiling some of his enthusiasm. "Where we're headed, it's not what you think. There's nothing like it in the galaxy." At 16, Molly knew hyperbole when she heard it, but she wasn't ready to respond. She'd let Young continue before mounting her defense. "The place we've been assigned to is, well, it's a whole new world to explore. To be honest, even that doesn't do it justice. And we'll have a real house with a real yard in a brand new town made specifically for researchers like us." "It almost sounds too good to be true," Molly interrupted, only partially attempting to restrain her sarcasm. If she didn't know him so well, she'd have guessed that he'd made the whole thing up. "Where exactly is this paradise?" His face took on a stern grimace. "Well, that's the thing, Molly. It's top secret. So you can't tell us all." Asha gave Young a tug on the shoulder. "Take it easy, hon. Molly's been with us for years now. You know that she's able to keep a secret." "I'm being serious," he said, going several shades colder. "Molly, where we're headed is a matter of naval intelligence. You know Oni, right? They're hardcore folks, and they keep their cards very close. Even casual conversations about what we're about to tell you could end badly for everyone." The Office of Naval Intelligence. That piqued Molly's attention. Since her new parents were now working on a site that had been the target of the Covenant during the war, Asha and Young were sometimes involved in highly classified projects. Over the past few years, that had become business as usual. Once in a while, they told Molly briefly about things they were working on, always using the vaguest terms and only after swearing her to complete secrecy. Molly knew that if she didn't keep this information safe, it could destroy them all. So no, the Office of Naval Intelligence did not play around. Molly narrowed her eyes at Young. "Now I'm actually intrigued." "Oh, honey," Asha said in a hurry. She'd seen that light in Molly's eyes before, and Asha wanted to rein her in before she got too excited about the wrong thing. "This new project doesn't have anything to do with the war. Not directly, at least." "It's better than that," Young said, struggling to restrain his excitement. "It's the most intriguing place in the entire galaxy." "So, what is it?" "You know what kind of work we do, right?" Asha asked. "You study alien cultures, like the Forerunners." "That's right," Young said. "None of that's classified, though," Molly said. It was hard for anyone to hide the news about the Forerunners, since the Covenant had dug up one of their artifacts in Kenya before the end of the war. Rumor had it that they excavated an enormous machine built 100,000 years ago, a structure over 100 kilometers wide. Specific knowledge about the Forerunners was still sketchy, at least to the public, but Molly had managed to fill in some of the gaps with what she'd gleaned from Asha and Young. "What you might not know, though, is that Oni funds our research of the Forerunner culture and technology. We're private contractors for them with the UEG," Asha said. "So our work ultimately helps the government reverse engineer the ancient technology in order to help build better tech for humanity in the future." Molly recognized this had to be true on some level, but she thought if Oni wanted this technology, it was probably for a specific purpose. "Why? Do they want to use it to fight someone?" "What? No." Young's face filled with concern. "Why would you think that?" He always bristled when Molly talked about fighting. He was determined to show her just how awful he thought it was. Sometimes he even seemed to take it personally, as if he were angry that she didn't want to become an academic like them. Molly didn't mean to insult their professions, but she'd watched them at work for years.
While she could see why their careers were both important and interesting, especially to them, if she had to sit in an office and try to grok alien tongues, or even go out to a dig in the middle of nowhere and unearth dusty old artifacts, she knew it would drive her mad. All of that was stuff done behind the scenes. Molly wanted to be on the front lines, right in the thick of things. Well, they were powerful, right? She asked. We study the Forerunners because their understanding of the universe was so much deeper than ours, Young responded patiently. Like Asha said, if we can decipher the things they left behind and then reverse engineer them, we can make massive leaps forward in our technology and our knowledge of the way things work. It's hugely valuable, not just to the UNSC, but to all of humanity. Everything from medicine to urban infrastructures and things like faster-than-light transportation. Their technology touches every aspect of our lives. But can't you just do that from here? I mean, haven't you been doing that? Yes, Asha smiled wanly. But that was a while ago. Years, even. We've finished what we came here to do, and exhausted most of what we were brought here to research. We're done with our core research now, and others will pick up where we left off. This next thing, that's what we're being tasked with again. Oh. A tragic picture spontaneously entered her mind. She could see where this was heading. The rest of her life on some backwater dust ball of a planet where she'd be lucky to find enough oxygen to breathe. Somewhere that would have even fewer people than Aranuka, if that was possible. The Office of Naval Intelligence has made some astonishing finds over the years since the war ended, Asha continued. And as it turns out, Young and I happen to be at the top of our fields with regard to researching Forerunner technology, especially in our respective areas of specialization. There aren't really any researchers out there with our specific skill sets, at least not readily available. So what? Molly tried to rein in her frustration. Why does this immediately mean another move? You just said they sent you the artifacts to research before. Can't they just do that again? They do, honey, Asha said, with some of the assets we research. But other artifacts are simply too big, even for the largest ships we have. There are Forerunner installations out there as massive as an entire world. The bottom line is that the UNSC needs every expert out in the field, doing this research in person. In particular, they need us. Something we've worked on in the past. Well, we have really intimate knowledge of it, Young said. In fact, no one understands these things as well as Asha and me. This is why Oni's reassigned us, and it's why we have to leave Aranuka. We need to be on site and doing the initial research in person. There's just no other way. The writing was on the wall, and Molly's fear began setting in. This was going to happen, no matter what she said. What is this place going to be like? Will it be dangerous? Will it be exposed to the Covenant? Asha and Young immediately sensed her palpable shift from fight to flight. Listen, Molly. Where we're going is entirely safe, Young said. When it comes to avoiding the threats that are out there, like whatever's left of the Covenant, this place, it might be the safest place in the galaxy. Molly had a hard time buying that. What's safer than Earth? Young smiled and looked at Asha, before turning back to Molly. Imagine living inside an immense hollow sphere, heavily secured from any and all outside forces, something that enemies can't attack from above. And then imagine that it's classified and completely off-limits to most of humanity, and so large it would actually take a full battalion of researchers several lifetimes to even come close to exploring it all. Honestly, Molly, the site I'm talking about here, there's so much room that we could lose the entire population of Earth in it and not even notice. Then he leaned in close with complete seriousness etched on his face. Hundreds of times over even. The fact that it exists at all is proof of just how unimaginably far ahead of us the Forerunners were from all other civilizations. Even the Covenant, said Asha. It's the largest and most profound single archaeological find.